All right, well, welcome to this session on psychedelics and spirituality. And let's open up with a word of prayer. That might be appropriate because we're dealing with some things that do involve, you know, spirits and such, too. But Heavenly Father, I just thank you for the opportunity. We just have to be together as your people to talk about a variety of topics, including some of the issues of our day and the challenges of our day. As we seek sometimes to minister to people who are caught up in things such as that, which we will be talking about this morning. So grant us, you know, understanding of how your word applies to that, and use this time to just to equip us for ministry to others. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's begin with a question. You know, what do Joe Rogan, he's one of the most popular podcasts, you know, millions and millions of people, perhaps tens of millions, follow Joe Rogan on his podcasts. What does he have in common with Aaron Rodgers, with Jordan Peterson? You know, what do they have in common? And the answer is they are all users of ayahuasca. And let me show you what that is. Ayahuasca is a traditional South American tea or brew made from boiled leaves and vines, and it's known for its hallucinogenic properties, primarily due to the presence of a chemical, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is a potent psychedelic substance. And it's been traditionally used in spiritual and religious ceremonies. And this is mainly in Brazil and in South America, but it has spread now. Its popularity in the West has skyrocketed. And for its potential, some say therapeutic benefits, and its ability to induce profound existential and spiritual experiences. So in his discussion, these are some of the components of ayahuasca. I'll come out to understand what it is. It's high in DMT, dimethyltryptamine, from a plant. Most commonly, the one Mimosa pudica, but other species are also used depending on what's locally available. And it's a vine is then added to that, which is a source of MOA inhibition. And I'm kind of giving you some of the pharmacology aspects of it because that's important to understand. MAO is a monoamine oxidase. It's an enzyme in the body that breaks down DMT almost immediately. And consuming a brew of pure Mimosa pudica would have no hallucinogenic effect. But when it's combined with the ayahuasca vine, it prevents the breakdown of DMT, and it then produces a powerful psychoactive substance. It becomes a powerful psychoactive substance. And in his discussion, Rogan describes his ayahuasca experiences as profoundly life-altering. He talks about entering a state of heightened consciousness where he gained new insights into his psyche and the nature of existence. And according to Rogan, these experiences provided him with a unique perspective, allowing him to reevaluate his understanding of life, of consciousness, of the interconnectedness of all things. And he relates encountering entities such as machine elves. And hold on to that. We'll come back to the whole matter of machine elves as we proceed, you know, through this. Aaron Rodgers, the Green Bay Packers quarterback, consumed ayahuasca prior to his back-to-back MVP seasons. And he described taking ayahuasca with his teammates as radically life-changing. And he claims that hundreds of other pro athletes have reached out to him about it and his taken them in on a number of ayahuasca retreats, traveling to Brazil and in some cases even here in the States.
To New York.
To, what's that?
To New York.
Yeah, exactly. But Rogers credited the plant-based psychedelic for helping produce his two best seasons ever, you know, of his career, thanks to a change in mindset and in improvement of his mental health. Now, Joe Rogan and Jordan Peterson, some of you may know who Jordan Peterson is. That he's been a very popular writer for, especially younger, you know, people. I had a Bible study with several young men in their late 20s and 30s. And when we first started meeting, a couple of them were all into Jordan Peterson, into his 12 Rules for Life and everything. In the podcast, you know, they talked about the history and the effects of psychedelics. And Dr. Peterson is a clinical psychologist, the author, again, of several best-selling books, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos, and 12 More Rules for Life because of the popularity of his first book. And he's also the host of a podcast, you know, of his own. And he thinks that psychedelics can lead to encounters with God. So from Sir Paul McCartney, and this is a picture of those who are engaging in retreats where the use of ayahuasca and other things are also used. And this is, you know, this can be found, you know, in New Mexico and certainly in Brazil and many other places. And I'll get into, there are even denominations of, you know, that have been around, you know, for a while, built up completely around the use of ayahuasca, too. And I'll share a little bit more about that. So ask the question, you know, what are, you know, psychedelics? We're not just going to be dealing with ayahuasca, but the psilocybin, mushrooms, there's hundreds of them, but a couple of them like peyote and others, you know, are peyote is not a mushroom, but it is a substance itself, a psychedelic substance. But the psychedelics, drugs, are a class of substance that interact with the serotonin receptors in the brain and causing an alteration in perception and sometimes resulting in visionary and hallucinatory experiences. And the most commonly used psychedelic drugs are LSD, DMT, you know, that I referred to, mescaline, and my pronunciation sometimes, and your pronunciation probably are some of these things are hard to just keep track of, and psilocybin mushrooms. Psilocybin is a naturally, this is a serotonin receptors, the different kinds of mushrooms from a hallucinatory perspective here. And this is, again, I've known a number of people, you know, who use mushrooms that look much like these over here. One young man that was counseling actually showed me a packet, a bunch of them, you know, that were there. They're looking much like a little more like dried up versions, you know, of these mushrooms there. Last summer, 2023, Denver hosted the largest psychedelic conference in history at the Colorado Convention Center. There were more than 300 exhibitors, and there were 10,000 attendees. Guests and speakers included Aaron Rodgers, former Texas governor, Rick Perry, singer Melissa Etheridge, the co-founder of Whole Foods, John Mackey, and National Institute of Mental Health director Joshua Gordon. And the 5-day event included dozens of panels pondering everything from the possibilities of psychedelics on mental health to, of course, new business opportunities, you know, involved with that, and greater community impacts, and how does substance fit into religion. 14 years ago, and then I'll explain this too, 14 years ago, a pastor approached me about renting our facility in Louisville for their weekly meeting, which involved the sacramental use of DMT. And he lived in an apartment complex right next door and to our facility. And he led a branch of, again, I'm not going to pronounce it right, this is in Portuguese, but a branch of the Uniano do Vegetal. And the Uniano do Vegetal is actually a denomination in Brazil that has spread throughout South America and into the United States. And there was a branch of them right next door to us. He had a group of about 25 people who met weekly, and they wanted a place more beyond their apartment, you know, to be able to meet. And they held a worship service, and they had prepared the ayahuasca brew, the tea, and the service was kind of like what you saw earlier in the larger image that I have of the retreats and all. But the service involved, you know, drinking on the tea and being in silence for a while. They described it much like a Quaker meeting, where they meet, they take the brew, they're in silence, and then they began after a while, you know, to share with each other, you know, whatever they were perceiving, whatever insights they were receiving. And they sang songs, you know, songs of, you know, of worship, and songs celebrating their experiences of encountering, you know, the divine within, in essence, and all. And like I said, this is there. Now, there were some legal challenges made out for the use of this brew. And they actually went to court. And in Gonzales versus, again, I'm not saying it right in Portuguese, but O Centro Espirito Beneficente Uniano do Vegetal, the Supreme Court heard arguments on November 1st, 2005, and unanimously ruled in February 2006 that the U.S. federal government must allow the Uniano do Vegetal, giving them the right to import and to consume the tea for religious ceremonies under the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, 50 years ago, or this is kind of drinking the brew there and then sharing again of the experience. Now, 50 years ago, while I was a student at Virginia Tech, again, in our outreaches and in our sharing experiences, you know, I met various people that used LSD at the time was the psychedelic of choice. And I remember one day in our dormitory, we showed a brief, you know, evangelistic movie, and a number of the students, you know, came down. And afterwards, he was just a fellow student, came up to me and says, "Oh, I've met Jesus. You know, I've encountered Jesus, and I believe in the Jesus you talk about, but I've already, you know, met him. I've already talked with him." And he told me that he was a consumer of LSD, a lysergic acid diethylamide is commonly known as LSD. It's a synthetic but potent psychedelic drug. Effects typically include intensified thoughts and emotions and sensory perceptions. And at sufficiently high dosages, LSD can produce mental and visual and auditory hallucinations. And sometimes what's put in a script that you could put on your tongue and then go into where you begin to perceive all those colors and fractal patterns and with sufficiently high dosages begin to encounter various entities. And so is the case of the use of other hallucinogens too. Now, for the record, I have never used natural or psychedelic substances. And I recommend that you don't ever do so as well. But LSD can catalyze, again, intense spiritual experiences. And as such, it is considered what's called an entheogen. And an entheogen is it's a neologism. That is a newly coined word in our generation. Basically, it's derived from two Greek words, you know, entheos, which means God within us, and genestai, creates or generates. So it helps to generate a perception of God within us. God with you. So such psychoactive substances are employed for visionary experiences in ritual and religious contexts. So the question is, you know, can psychedelics really bring you closer to God? DMT has been called the spirit drug, the spirit molecule. And even it's been called a Jesus drug. Again, for encountering this entity, you know, who presents himself as Jesus to some. And some people who have taken dimethyltryptamine believe that they have encountered God or Jesus during their hallucinogenic vision. And some say that it led them to change their lives for the better and becoming dedicated Christians. So that brings us to the point, you know, what does the Bible have to say about it? Is it truly awakening the divine within? What does the Bible have to say about it? And I do believe that the scriptures do speak to us about that. The Bible references drugs used for occult purposes. Occult is a term that means, you know, encountering spirits and entering into visionary experiences with them. The Bible references drugs used for occult purposes. There's a word family that deals, I think, specifically with that, with the main word being pharmakeia. And I'll take you through there's three basic words in this family, in this word family that they, and they're all related, formicare, formicos, formicon. And in the New Testament references, that refers to the use of potions to induce trance states in those who want to contact the spirit world. So formicare, let's see if I have the verse references. Yes, a number of for the use of formicare itself as being the general word for sorcery, for magic. One of the places where we find the first use we find of it in Galatians 5:19-21 in that list of the works of the flesh. Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, and so on. Now, doesn't define for us in context exactly what sorcery is, but by the word and its use, both in the Septuagint in the Old Testament for some Hebrew words and in the New Testament, the Greek, this word family, I think clearly helps us understand what is indeed formicaia, what is a sorcery. So Galatians 5:20 here in the reference to it. So there's two specific usage of this one of the word family, the formicaia. The others in Revelation 18:23 says, the light of the lamp shall not shine in you anymore, and the voice of bridegroom and bride shall not be heard in you anymore. For you merchants, and this is talking about religious Babylon and also there's commercial Babylon. But here, for you merchants were the great men of the earth, for by your sorcery all the nations were deceived. The next word in the family is formicos. And here, sometimes it's used in reference to a poisoner, to one who makes a potion, basically, to get rid, you know, of someone. But also, generally, too, of the use of potion. So, by sorcerer, to induce his own twin states and that of others, too. But the cowardly, in Revelation 21:8, we're told the cowardly, the unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, all lies shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire. Again, a condemnation of those who's or characterized by that and who never believed, you know, too. And also Revelation 22:15, but outside, again, are dogs and sorcerers and so on there. The third word of the family is formicon. And formicon refers to the specific drug itself. And potion, or whatever it is. So it can be a drug, an enchantment, a magic potion, such as ayahuasca, for the purpose, again, of inducing and inducing hallucinatory states and encountering spirit guides. So those three words are the word family that we have in the New Testament and in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, too. And for that last word, and they did not repent, Revelation 9:21, for the ongoing judgments of the tribulation period, and they did not repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or theft. And likewise, the Old Testament forbade occult practices, again, including sorcery. So here this is the Septuagint translation of the Deuteronomy 18:10. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire, or one who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer. So in that context, again, it's speaking of things such as like the Oracle at Delphi. And who used hallucinatory things to gain, again, visions and make forecasts of those who inquired of them and so on there too. Also Exodus 7:11 of the magicians who confronted Moses and were able to replicate some of the early miracles that he made. It says, but Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers. So the magicians of Egypt, they also did in like manner with their enchantments. And the implication is that they did some supernatural things. But by use of the spirit entities that they were involved with and in communication with. So now the word for Malachi also. Again, you see the trend I've given you both to the New Testament, to the Old Testament. Malachi 3:5. God says, and I will come near you for judgment. I will be a swift witness against sorcerers. Here they lead the list. Adulterers, perjurers, and so on, says the Lord of hosts. Now, formicia can be neutral, the word itself, as we use it now. You know, we use a form of the word. Every time you go fulfill the prescription, where do you go? You know, to a pharmacy, to a drug dispenser. So they use that word, and they use the symbol that I've been representing here without this little curly Q thing. And the curly Q thing that I have here represents the vine, like the ayahuasca, you know, vine. But, you know, the serpent and the cup is a common logo, image of for pharmacists and pharmacies, too. So it's an interesting thing, you know, in the, even in the symbols, you know, that have carried on in, you know, for us. So I would say, again, the Bible prohibits the use of drugs for spiritual and occult purposes under the word sorcery. Sorcerers often use drugs along with their incantations to conjure occult powers, supernatural powers. So I'll transition into the whole matter of shamanism. There was someone I commented earlier, you know, wondering what shamanism was about, you know, too. So, shamanism covers an assortment of beliefs and practices for the purpose of spiritual contacts. Shamans often use entheogenic plants to induce visionary states, again, such as ayahuasca and peyote. Entheogenic plants have hallucinogenic properties, and peyote is a cactus that's been long used to take out the, well, this picture's a shaman, you know, here, and what the green is represents the leaves of a plant, you know, that shamans might use to produce, you know, a hallucinogenic brew of some kind. Here, so that's actually the best representation, I think, of a shaman that, especially in the popularity of DMT now, you know, in the West, too. But this is the peyote cactus, long used in parts of Mexico and Texas by some Native Americans, but now it's spreading. It has spread, you know, much beyond that. And shamanism is part of the occult. You know, the shaman enters an altered state of consciousness to obtain his spirit guide and to effect his sorcery. And this can be facilitated by mind-altering drugs. And such drugs can loosen the normal connection between the brain and the human spirit and open the way for a familiar spirit to affect the brain. And again, as I've defined, an entheogen is a psychoactive substance used in religious, shamanic, or spiritual contexts. And now you can search and find, if you so desire, a shamanic life coach, you know, to take you through the process of transformation. And the use of such hallucinogenic drugs can be very dangerous. So that's why they say always do so, you know, with under supervision and even back in the 70s when anyone used LSD, they were cautioned, always have someone along with you when you do that, because the users of LSD started to believe that they could fly. And what will they do? You know, they will go to the top of a building and fly out. And said, make sure you have someone to restrain you from doing, you know, such things. Just enjoy the other, you know, aspects, you know, of it. So, I'm not kidding. There are shamanic life coaches, you know, out there offering their services there. And people can go to these retreats to have this group experience, you know, as part of it, and this community experience. Again, this function as a, for some, they say as a church-like, you know, gathering for them. You know, some of the reported experiences of some who have that, this is again people that relate their testimonies, just like believers have their testimonies, others, you know, have their testimonies. This is from Brad Green. He said this, quote, when I first took acid, and by that he means LSD, I took quick enough doses just to have fun and see colors and psychedelic patterns. But when I started taking really heavy doses, I got a spirit guide. And after that, whenever I took psychedelic drugs, I was always guided by spirit beings. I had spirit teachers showing me lessons, making diagrams right in front of me. Now, many users of DMT report visitations from intelligences who impart information, and some reference them as DMT elves or machine elves, humanoid creatures that live in the psychedelic hyperspace. And if you make a Google search just of machine elves, you're going to come up with thousands, because there are many people who are autistic, and many users of such substances also kind of have an autistic tendency. So they reproduce in art all of these things that they are seeing and experiencing. And just enter in machine elves or DMT, you know, visions, and they'll pop up thousands of images such as these. This is what they actually claim, you know, to be seeing, and sometimes even taking definite, really form, like this. And you can see what they call a machine elves. It's really an elf-like vision. Some it's more kind of a general, but you still see, you know, there are figures of enlightenment figures, and like, you know, we might say, like, even you might see in Buddhism too. And some even encounter spirit-like animals, and as such, these animals can also become your soul animal. You know, you saw spirit guide, especially with the use of mushrooms. And again, the Native American things, you know, animal spirit guides, you know, are very important, you know, in the culture. And that's what they're encountering on those visionary journeys as well. Now, this is how they have different many names, angels or spirit, clockwork elves, DMT aliens, DMT entities, divine beings, fractal elves, you know, self-transforming machine elves, and so on, too. And some theories about what these are, some say they are simply denizens of the DMT, the dimethyltryptamine realm that's produced. Some say, you know, saying that materialist might say, this is just the human brain as a fractal generator. So the substances just kind of causes your brain itself to, like a kaleidoscope. You know, you put it in, and then you begin to see all these patterns or images, and that's just a biochemical function of the brain producing all of that. Some say it's alien communication, or it's contact with one's own innate divinity. Or it's maybe masquerading spirit entities. For even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light, you know, seeking, you know, to deceive. Yeah, Satan himself transforms himself into an angel of light. And by implication, you know, all of the fallen other angels, you know, that associated with him there. So what about this? And I keep track of the time. Let's see. Yes. Entheogens in Christendom. How is that being occurring today? Again, in researching this, I begin to find, you know, doctoral thesis even from some theological schools, you know, that are written, you know, about that. Here's one of them from George Fox University, and this was a doctoral thesis, and I'm just going to read a portion of the abstract, you know, and as he gives an overview of what he's about to do. It says, this dissertation aims to consider whether Jesus' followers in North America could begin to adopt entheogens as items of sacramental worship, much like that church I started in Brazil, and which had a branch next door to me, literally, of our church. So Section 1 will describe the opportunity on the horizon for the institutional church in North America. Section 2 will focus on alternative readings of biblical texts. Of course, got to have an there as the basis of convictions for entheogenic use. By looking at a history of entheogens around the world, I attempt to show that entheogenic use is not a new trend to adopt, but part of religious history. Additionally, I will present a proposed path forward on a cultural-wide adoption of entheogens. Section 3 will consider the potential of entheogens as sacramental objects. I will use my training to re-sign the concept of sacraments by focusing on sacraments throughout Christian history and present a larger scope of what could define sacramental. Section 4 will describe what an entheogenic retreat would look like, and I gave you a picture of that. Since sharing my experience, many have approached me to lead them through a similar experience. So in this section, I will suggest what that environment and setting might look like. And if it is indeed a religious setting, the Supreme Court has said that that can't be hindered here under the freedom of religion. Section 5 will include the mechanics of hosting an entheogenic retreat. And this section will feel highly pragmatic as I delve into the artifacts, schedule, budget, purpose, form, and function. And section 6 will share what I have learned throughout the process. We'll note problems that have come to light through the process and will offer helpful suggestion for the future of research and conversation in this area. And this is the conclusion of his abstract for the dissertation. The evangelical church in North America has often shown up late to culturally relevant conversations. For there to be beauty that grows from the rubble of a post-Christian church, it will be of importance for the church to provide a Christ-following analysis of whatever new topic might be on the horizon. And if you haven't been aware of it, this topic is not on the horizon. It's big. It may not be big in our circles, in our church circles, but it's big. It's big in the West, in the Western world. And there are others, you know, it's being, some programs in chaplaincy, you know, are encouraging the use of that. And the emerging role of professional chaplains in psychedelic, care. And this organization is a significant one, actually, for chaplains. Again, the sacramental use of this is being encouraged, and psychedelic theology is a developing field. And again, I want to leave time for questions, so I won't go too much more into depth. But this is actually a website that a believer, he says he's a believer, and I don't know. But he says he is, but he wants to advance the whole area of psychedelic theology. So he has a website with hundreds, you know, of articles and stuff, you know, to support that. And this is what he has in his front page, you know, for his website. After experiencing psilocybin for the first time in 2021, this is, again, recent, and who knows if it's affected by COVID, a post-COVID type of thing, that transformations that's occurring, I found a powerful medicine for treating the suicidal ideation, depression, and anxiety that I had struggled with for a decade. As an open-minded Christian minister, I knew that the psychedelic experience did more than affect my physical brain. It also had enormous spiritual and metaphysical implications. However, I was disappointed to find that there were few informed voices that sought to seriously address these substances, and the experiences that they caused within the context of Christian faith and practice. So as a graduate student at Duke Divinity School, I decided to fill that gap by focusing my studies on the mind, theology, and different altered states of consciousness. Psychedelic theology is a result of that research and work. So I hope that can be, that's not me, I'm just quoting here. No. So I hope that psychedelic theology can become a resource for new psychonauts. Yes, curious onlookers or lifelong seekers there. Yeah. What's that? And there are university centers. Of course, you know, Timothy Leary at Harvard University back in the late 50s and 60s started using LSD. It's a synthetic substance, but a synthetic substance is just a slight alteration of a natural substance. There was a researcher by accident. He was working with the molds that grew on some grain stalks and everything. And there's this one particular fungus that grows on them that has hallucinogenic properties. And somehow he absorbed them through his skin and had this hallucinogenic, you know, experience. And from that, he took that ergot, it's called, the ergot mold on grain, on different types of grains that may do. So from that, he synthesized then, you know, LSD, and Timothy Leary took it, you know, to Harvard and everything, and really encouraged, you know, greatly its use, too. But now, there are centers, world-renowned centers for the research of psychedelic drugs, initially in therapy, but as you read earlier, you know, in he began with taking that for, you know, therapy for his anxiety and depression, but then went way beyond that. And Johns Hopkins University has a Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. And with tens of millions of dollars donated, the initial donation was $50 million, and it's increased, you know, since then for its research facility. I've given you the link, so you can actually, in your notes, you can actually, you know, go and see what they say. UC Berkeley, the Center for the Science of Psychedelics, exploring the potential of psychedelics for the betterment of. Now, we'll start saying we just want to treat those with PTSD syndromes and everything, but it's actually, what does it say? I mean, they're up front on their first page. It's for the betterment of all, you know, too. And, oh, this is I was talking with one of the guy, one of our elders, who is a medical doctor. And when I begin, you know, I tell him I was developing this, let him look it over and everything, and he quickly began to research it, and he found an article from the 4th, just from May 4th, on that concerning ayahuasca, what it is and what its risks, you know, are, and it went a lot into the pharmacology of it and the dangers, you know, all the potential side effects and everything, and ended, you know, there urging. This is not sufficient research to support its use in a therapeutic setting or into any general setting. And to its credit, this if I can find the article, I'll give you the correct name for it. Yeah. Can't find it right now. But it's a Cleveland Medical Clinic, a significant medical group, research group, that counsels against it and really does list what happens in the brain and what all the potential, you know, side effects are, too. But ending again, we have this whole matter of ayahuasca, and my conclusion is this. All right. Don't seek God in your brain through drugs, but in spirit and truth with a clear head. And the Bible, you know, we might say, open before you. Yeah. So we'll stop there, you know too, and see. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I guess we still can take a couple minutes. It's 17 off, and I think the next, it's at 11 o'clock, the next meeting downstairs, you know, too. And there's not one here that I know of up here, so we can take 5 more minutes. Well, you comments? You know, if, I'm always wanting to hear what you've encountered, you know, in others, or what's your life experience, you know, has been. So, well, we'll begin with you, you know, Chester, too.
Chainsaws for good purposes, but they're a dangerous tool, right?
Yeah.
Do you chemicals as a dangerous tool or something worse? Because it seems to me like the separating of the perception and the processing for real cases like PTSD may actually have some value. But you're playing with, you know, you're juggling.
Now it is, I said, it's a natural substance. So some will argue, well, because this is a natural substance, you know, it can be helpful. it can be used. Now for what you said, you know, if I guess a clinical, you know, psychologist or psychiatrist, you know, under very limited things finds and supervision finds that, I might have to say I hold judgment,
yeah,
you know, on that, but
the function is to alter the mindset so that they're more susceptible to messaging, right?
And right,
so,
and that's the occult purpose, and that's what I clearly condemn.
Usage, it's to allow you to drop your guard, it were, so that the messaging can get through and stick, and so then you're really dealing with a spiritual leader.
Right.
Giving you messages,
yeah. That's a perfect way, to do it. Are there other ways, you know, for PTSD? You know, there's a number of therapies, you know, that are helpful and effective. And, you know, could just be one of last resort in the case, you know, of a psychiatrist, you know, we're very limited, you know. Even the church that I referred to, you know, that he told me very directly, it's under supervision and it's not a strong potion, you know, too. They're careful. But yet but the Cleveland Clinic that I referred to, one of the statements, it says even with the best intentions, it's hard to restrict even not knowing the proper dosages and, for different people, you know, for some people, just a very little bit of it can really send you way off and open the way for spirit entities, you know, too. So again, I've read, you know, the clinical, you know, aspects of it but it's growing though. The psychiatric community is actually divided, you know, on that, but there are some that are promoting it very much, too. Let me go to someone in the back because he had his hand up right, you know, first, so then we'll come back. Go ahead.
What are your thoughts on the trance that Paul was in a trance in the book of Acts and Peter was in a trance?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that as far as altered state of consciousness and meditation?
Yeah.
And that word is translated also as astonishment in places, ecstasis, but it appears to be that they were in a perhaps an altered state of consciousness.
Sure. Now, first of all, you know, it wasn't through meditation. Well, of course, we're told that Peter was praying, but I don't think he was praying the sense of contemplative spirituality. You know, he was really praying. and then I think he fell asleep, and then the vision of the, of the great sheet filled with unclean animals, you know, came down. But first of all, it was not at their initiative. It wasn't to the use of chemical substances. It was God's initiation and through. And we know, you know, from Hebrews 1 that God in passages spoke, you know, in many ways, you know, through the prophets and others in visions and dreams and everything. But in these last days, he has spoken to us through his Son. And that's the final, you know, revelation. And then, of course, in Hebrews 2, 1 through 4, you know, we're told we're to be careful not to drift from what has what was first revealed by the Lord, you know, to the apostles and transmitted, you know, to us. So we're restricted, you know, to that. But you know, of course, you know, Paul actually tells us he wasn't completely sure whether he was in the body, you know, totally transported or simply somehow in the spirit taken to the third heaven, you know, too, and saw things that he is not permitted or he could not even put into words, too. But he says then, so that I don't exalt myself, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, you know, to keep me humble. So again, don't seek visions and of extract because you might also be given a thorn in the flesh, you know, too. We might say, you know. Too. But again, this the difference is who initiated it and who and to whom, you know, too. Where we don't have apostles, you know, such as Paul and Peter and such. All right, and let me come back to here, and then we'll go back to you. Go ahead.
Said there's nothing really new under the sun.
Yeah.
And I've been studying a little bit about the Gnostics and they've borrowed Platonic philosophy, which went all the way back to Egypt and Babylon, who believed in the idea that God cannot be objectively known. It has to be sought subjectively.
It has to be an experience. I mean, it was
that. Why they're doing this, because they've rejected the objective truth.
True.
And therefore, they're still religious, and they still want to know something about God. And I think it's through these experiences that's going to get them closer. And these, are you familiar with emanation theory? So they believe that God was emanating certain spirit beings that kind of just
And then you have different levels of them and everything.
Closer to these beings who then are closer to God. It's like a Jacob's ladder of beings. Visions of getting, working our way closer to God through these experiences.
Yes.
And that's how we encounter God, not through objective truth, but subjectively.
Yes, and that's the whole, mysticism, the whole development of, and Jacob's ladder is a terminology they even use, like you said, in that, you know, too. Yes, very good comment. Yes.
This should not be unexpected. Isn't it predicted in Revelation, like one of the things for
Yeah. In fact, I was saying that earlier, like, God would even have paused some of the judgments during the 70th week of if they had repented of their sorceries. You know, even that's one of the uses of the term in Revelation. And it seems that it will be greatly expanded during that period, and I think the period leading up to it, as we're seeing it occurring now, you know, too. But, go ahead.
More recently in fiction, there's been a rise in, like, altering the body past human levels.
Yeah.
So like this is obviously like more hallucinogenic stuff, but if you ran over anything more like enhancing physical performance past natural levels, like in the morality and from a Christian view of that, have you ran any of that in the research for this?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. Just doing it apart from the use of any hallucinogens or any other any other steroid use or anything else, you know, like that, you know, too. But just through some natural pathways, you know, to that thing.
Using drugs to.
Or using drugs to that.
Like perform. But purely physical.
Yeah, physical, yes, you know, too. That's part of what, even in those research centers, what they said what it can do to enhance other aspect of, you know, of the body, you know. And strength. But I haven't delved fully, you know, into it's like I said, it's a huge literature that's out there, you know, on now on many different facets. But that might be something good for you to explore further and to write about and take it a step further. I'm trying to be more like Bob Wilkin, you know. In fact, the very first time that I wrote anything for GES, you know, Peter and I were having lunch with Bob Wilkin, you know, too, and I mentioned the whole matter of contemplative spirituality. That was showing up in a network of pastors and churches that I knew. And Bob Wilkins, you know, first thing, why don't you do a workshop about that and write it up for the journal? And that's what I did. And you can go back. It was back in 2007. You can read the journal article there on contemplative spirituality, you know, too, which is a drugless way to somehow achieve some of the same effects. And, too. I think I need to end here to give you time to go to the last session. So let me see. Well, you have 9 minutes. So if you want to come up and just ask me a question, you know, that'd be fine. I'll hang around. Yeah.